Most view autism as a devastating disorder, one that needs to be cured. But could it be viewed as a form of diversity? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, we listen back to Ben Kiefer's conversation with two Grinnell residents, Emily Thornton Savarese and Ralph James Savarese, parents of an autistic child. They are the editors of a special issue of Disability Studies Quarterly entitled Autism and the Concept of Neurodiversity. Also joining the conversation, a Syracuse College student diagnosed with autism. The conversation comes up after the news.
I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. Most of us, parents and the public at large, view autism as a devastating disorder, one that needs to be cured. But could autism instead be viewed as a form of diversity? Diversity like race or ethnicity? Well, that's a central question we'll explore this hour. Joining me first of all in the hour, Emily Thornton Savarese and Ralph James Savarese. They are residents of Grinnell, Iowa, also editors of a special issue of Disability Studies Quarterly entitled Autism and the Concept of Neurodiversity. For many years, Emily Savarese was the assistant director of the Center for Autism and Related Disabilities at the University of Florida in Gainesville. Now she is an inclusion specialist who has presented at various conferences and universities on topics related to literacy for non-speaking autistic people. Ralph Savarese is associate professor of English at Grinnell College, where he teaches American literature, creative writing, and disability studies. He is the author, with his autistic son, of the 2007 award-winning book Reasonable People, a memoir of autism and adoption. Newsweek called the book a real-life love story and a passionate manifesto for the rights of people with neurological disabilities. Emily and Ralph are the proud parents of DJ, the 17-year-old boy with autism, who types to communicate. DJ, despite having been labeled profoundly mentally retarded, was just elected to the National Honor Society at junior high school. Emily Savarese joins us today by phone from Grinnell. Good afternoon, Emily. Emily, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Ralph joins me. He's in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Good afternoon, Ralph.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
What is neurodiversity to start out with? This is a new term for many of our listeners. What is neurodiversity and how can neurological disability be thought of something as akin to the difference in race or ethnicity?
So basically what the term neurodiversity suggests is that something like autism is a kind of atypical neurological development that is a normal human difference that should be recognized and respected like any other difference. And we took our cue with this special issue from leading autistic self-advocates at all points on the spectrum, those who carry the label of severe autism, those who carry the label of Asperger's syndrome, who were tired of being represented in strictly pathological and really, finally, demeaning terms. And these self-advocates borrowed from earlier civil rights movements involving African Americans, women, gays, and suggested that these groups historically were demeaned and underestimated and that they are a lot like these groups. Of course, that analogy breaks down to some extent with respect to the question of disability. And it's clear that autism has, especially at the so-called severe end or low-functioning end, terms that I don't like, that there are really significant challenges. But those challenges aren't the whole story by any means. And the other thing I'd say just very briefly is the research on autism, especially classical autism, has been very, very poor. And I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk about that.
Emily is on the line joining us. I don't know if your husband there explaining to us the idea of neurodiversity. And we heard anything to add to that? For instance, why should we view autism not as a disorder to cure?
Well, I think if you become familiar with the words of so many of the self-advocates who are on the autism spectrum, that question gets answered for you. These are incredibly accomplished bright, thoughtful, insightful, justice-minded people.
So the reason to do this, though, to view it as diversity rather than a disorder, where does that get us?
Well, I mean, let me just tell a quick story. I remember my son in the sixth grade before bed one night typing on his computer, "Dad, freak is ready for bed." And at that point, both Emily and I had fully realized the extent to which the world is not as hospitable as it needs to be to serious differences. And part of what we're talking about is making a space in the world where people with autism can have meaningful, fulfilling lives. And it's also a very practical thing. And we're talking to parents here. Building self-esteem in young people, whether they have autism or not, is a challenging project. And if you can make somebody feel okay about who they are, they're more likely to flourish. You know, later that year, DJ wrote on a Father's Day card, "Dad, thanks for not thinking I'm freaky." Hmm. And I wrote, "Thanks for not thinking I'm freaky." You know, I mean,
how do you respond, though, to people who would say that by adopting this neurodiverse view, you are ignoring the disabling aspects of this condition, the significant motor impairments, the anxiety, the extremely repetitive behavior, the hitting the head on whatever, an aversion to the social connection?
Right. Em, why don't you start?
Well, I think we're asking not only for acceptance and understanding, but also for the support that's needed for these people to be successful, to overcome some of the challenges that seem to people to be unable to be overcome. But in fact, we're learning from many people on the spectrum who are now adults that they can overcome and work around communication and anxiety issues that they have.
Yeah, and I think that's really, really important. We are not saying, well, you heard me earlier say that the analogy to earlier civil rights movements breaks down in part because clearly being black is not a disability, being gay is not a disability. Being autistic is a it comes with significantly disabling aspects, especially at one end of the spectrum. But those things can be worked with. We're not against respectful therapies of any kind. Our son has had all sorts of occupational therapy, speech language therapy, anxiety counseling, you name it. So we're not against these therapies. What we're against is this idea of imagining that autism is strictly pathological.
Are you against the word, for instance, disorder and finding a cure for this disorder?
I would say that I would prefer not to use the word disorder. The issue of a cure is very, very complicated because we're nowhere near that. My problem with the cure is let's try to address the challenges that autistic people have, give them a chance to live fulfilling lives, and then decide whether we are so rabidly committed to this idea of erasing autism from the planet. I think it's way too early. We're in the beginning of an autistic renaissance where all sorts of people, especially at the so-called low end of the function at the end of the spectrum, are doing things. They're going to school. They're going to college. They're writing books. They're writing screenplays. We're nowhere near the point where we can talk credibly about whether we should erase autism, especially the more disabling kinds.
At the most fundamental level, aren't you talking about a redefinition of normalcy or a broader definition of normalcy?
Sure. Anne, why don't you tackle that one?
Or maybe doing away with the term normalcy and a realization that people think they learn, they achieve in very different ways, taking very different pathways. And who are we to say that everybody must walk down the same path, whether it be to literacy, to a successful life?
And you go ahead.
To what extent, though, would autism, at whatever level of functionality, seem less devastating if culture were to be more accommodating and hospitable?
Well, for example, if you taught literacy training, rigorous literacy training, and gave people who can't speak a way, a communication system, and you could suddenly start hearing what is bothering them or empowering them to take control over aspects of their lives, giving them opportunities, the same kinds of opportunities that motivate neurotypical people, you'd see a big change. We saw an enormous change in our son when literacy came about.
And let's be clear, DJ, when you adopted DJ at the age of?
Six.
At the age of six, when you first met him, he was walled off.
Oh, absolutely. In diapers, no eye contact, massive perseveration. And on top of that, he had been very badly abused in foster care. And as a result, we had all sorts of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder issues. Literacy was crucial, but also occupational therapy, becoming more in touch with his body. I'll tell you, some of the occupational therapy allowed me, for example, to wash DJ's hair. His head, his scalp was so hypersensitive that he couldn't let us do that. Well, we've been able to work with that, and now he loves having his hair washed,
mm-hmm.
and he does it himself.
In this issue of called Autism and the Concept of Neurodiversity and Disability Studies Quarterly, the new one to be found online as well right now, you point out that this isn't only for the high-functioning end of autism because many of the people who write in this edition are have severe autism.
That's right. At least eight would carry the label of severe or classical autism. And many of them type to communicate. One young man, Tito Mukupati, who's authored three books. He's in Austin, Texas. He writes totally independently. Absolutely. I think that's one of the major things we're trying to underscore here is the need to see neurodiversity not just at the so-called higher end of the spectrum or with Asperger's syndrome. It is very, very important to allow folks who are more significantly autistic to view themselves positively, as long as we're working on some of the significant challenges.
Okay. Before we go, we have to take a short break. So your goals in a nutshell here are to move from being described, this is being described as a pathology.
Yeah, absolutely.
A disorder to something that we accept and treat, but not to get rid of?
Not to get rid of. And we'll talk about that later. There are clear studies that show that autistics do certain things better than neurotypical people do. It would be a very bad idea. In fact, I believe that if autistics were working on the encryption codes in the Second World War, it would have ended a year earlier.
We're talking about the idea, the term neurodiversity. That's an idea that atypical neurological development, such as autism, is a normal human difference that is to be recognized and respected as any other human variation. My guests, Emily Savarese and Ralph Savarese, editors of a special issue of Disability Studies Quarterly entitled Autism and the Concept of Neurodiversity. Two other guests joining us now, Jamie Burke, labeled severely autistic. He's a junior at Syracuse University, from where he joins us. He's been a presenter at conferences throughout the United States, around the world. In fact, in 2001, Syracuse University produced an award-winning video written and narrated by Jamie, entitled Inside the Edge, A Journey to Using Speech Through Typing. He's appeared in People magazine, in Time, on CNN. He joins us from public radio WAER in Syracuse. And I'm going to ask you, Ralph, to jump in here too, because I've not communicated with Jamie before. And Jamie communicates using a keyboard. Jamie, can you say hi, or are we connected?
Yes.
Hi, everyone. And I am a senior, folks.
Oh, I am so sorry. I had old information. Congratulations on becoming an upperclassman, Jamie. And I want to ask you a question because I understand you'll be using your keyboard to answer it and need perhaps a little bit of a moment. Tell us how this keyboard helps you speak, because I understand you speak using the typing. How did you learn to do this? And when did you learn to do this? In the meantime, I'd like to introduce our other guest joining us, Scott Robertson, Vice President of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and he's an adult with autism. He is on the autism spectrum. Would you say, Scott, are you there? Scott, are you there? Scott's not there for the moment. Let's go back to Jamie Burke. Can you tell us now how you learned to speak and why you need typing to verbalize with us?
Well, this is so exciting to be with everybody, and my love of life and knowledge is fundamental, period.
Well, this is so exciting to be with everyone, to be with everybody, and my love of life and knowledge is fundamental.
Very good. Now, you are using both, we heard the computer voice and then your voice here. How do you work with a computer? By typing it, you've learned to then verbalize it. That
Absolutely.
Is the pathway that your communication could go through, whereas it demonstrates how it's different than ours.
Patterns. Power.
We hear Jamie talking there.
Yeah.
Powerful.
Go ahead and give us some commentary.
Yeah, so Jamie learned how to speak at the age of 12, 13, through typing. When you hear the mechanized voice, the text-to-voice synthesizer, that's the way he
Great.
Communicated, the way my son communicates, the way any number of the people in the journal communicate. They type, and then the computer produces a mechanized sound. The thing that makes Jamie so distinctive is that he's learned through typing how to use his voice, and it really has defied all of the experts, because it's generally understood that if you're not speaking by 4 or 6, certainly 8 at the latest, you're not going to speak. And that's changed. That's one of the things that's changing.
So Jamie needs to hear the words pronounced by the computer in order to do it?
I don't know. We'll hear what Jamie says.
Let's see if Jamie's there.
Yeah. So Jamie,
here's his answer, I believe.
Yeah. Go read it, Jamie.
Absolutely. The patterns are powerful only when brains are given a thoughtful way of exchange.
I think that's really important. What Jamie has told me is how important the physical motor activity of typing is in order to help him get his brain to allow him to speak. Is that right, Jamie?
Okay. Jamie's in Syracuse typing on his keyboard.
Yeah, and then he'll
Absolutely.
Read.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so what Jamie does is he needs to type, and it's literally the motor memory of typing out an answer that then allows him, he's trained himself, to then be able to read aloud what he has typed. So this must be for our listeners or your listeners, Ben, a very unusual experience, but this is what's so terrific, is to have people with autism advocating for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And to your knowledge, Ralph, this doesn't happen every day on radio or in the media very, very much.
Ever.
Ever. I want to put a question out to Jamie and then ask you another one, Ralph. Jamie has been fully included in this. And Emily, I don't know if you're still there.
Yes, I am.
Now, you are an inclusion specialist, which means what?
It means that I work with schools and families and people on the spectrum to provide the supports that are necessary to allow kids to be successful in regular classrooms, mm-hmm. learning the regular curriculum.
I want to ask you that question, but I want to ask Jamie, so he can type out the answer, what has full inclusion in regular education meant for you, Jamie? How has it made you different than you would have otherwise been had you been treated without being included in a regular education? And in the meantime, Emily, can you tell us about that? What is the thinking here?
Well, I think it's important to say that, for one thing, not everybody on the spectrum necessarily is in favor of school inclusion. They are in favor of life inclusion. I happen to be in favor of school inclusion because I think school is where kids first socialize. They first get a sense of what it means to get along, to make decisions, and that if we leave these kids with autism out of those discussions and out of that formation of society, then I think it's more likely we're going to leave them out as they get older.
Let's see if Jamie has an answer for us to tell us about
Perhaps.
This. Being included, Jamie.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's the power of belief in the soul of the independent individual. Inclusion is important initiation to life.
Hmm.
That is excellent, Jamie. Absolutely excellent. I think you said it better than any of us could possibly say it.
This is a question I know was asked of Temple Grandin in a recent interview. She has high-functioning autism, but I'll ask it of you, Jamie Burke. Would you want to be cured? Would you want to be, in your lingo, a neurotypical? Or, no, neurotypical.
Yes.
You are a neurotypical. Would you want to be cured of autism, if that was possible?
And maybe while Jamie's answering, you know, when DJ, our son, was interviewed by Sanjay Gupta, he put a similar question to him and asked him whether autism should be treated. And DJ typed out, yes, treated with respect.
Hmm, very good. Jamie, what about you? Would you want to be cured, if you could, of autism?
I can hear him. I can hear Jamie typing.
Yeah. He is.
This is a regular sound in our house as well.
So with your son, DJ, he has a keyboard with him everywhere?
Yeah, and either a laptop or a smaller little labeler machine. Yeah, we have to have a keyboard everywhere so that he can tell us what he wants, what he's thinking. You were talking about, until Jamie's done, you were suggesting that Temple Grandin said she wouldn't want to be cured. There are all sorts of folks, and I'm not sure it can perfectly correlate to so-called milder forms of autism. I know any number of folks who carry the label of classical or severe autism who say with the right supports and the right attitude, they would not feel compelled to be normal because there are certain things they do better than we do.
We're going to take a short break in a minute, but perhaps we'll have time for Jamie's answer in just a moment. But I want to reach out to our listeners to hear your thoughts as you hear this conversation, this one-of-a-kind conversation with Jamie. Do you agree that autism is to be treated more as a form of diversity, neurological diversity? We want to reach out to those especially whose lives have been touched by autism, parents, family members, 1-866-780-9100. Jamie, we've got to go into a break. You've got to you want to say something?
Yes, go ahead first. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Truri Wealth. Understanding your own truth is the important journey. To be cured is to be strongly denied my personhood.
Excellent. Excellent.
Very
excellent.
Good. Jamie, please stay with us. Joining us from Syracuse University, a live conversation with Jamie, who has been labeled severely autistic. He is a senior, not a junior anymore, a senior at Syracuse University and a great advocate for self-advocacy.
Coming up, more of Ben's conversation looking at autism and how some view it as a form of diversity. His guests, Emily Thornton Savarese and Ralph James Savarese, Grinnell residents and editors of a special issue of Disability Studies Quarterly entitled Autism and the Concept of Neurodiversity. More coming up after the news. This is an archive edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio.
I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. Today, talking about neurodiversity, perhaps a term you've never heard. It's an idea that atypical neurological development, such as autism, is a normal human difference, not a disorder to be cured. And it's to be recognized, say its proponents, and respected as any other human variation. Joining us, Emily Savarese and Ralph Savarese, editors of a special issue of Disability Studies Quarterly entitled Autism and the Concept of Neurodiversity. They join us. Ralph is here in Iowa City in the studio, and Emily from Grinnell, Iowa. Jamie Burke joining us as well, labeled severely autistic. He is now a senior at Syracuse University. He joins us from the public radio station there. And we hope now to go to Scott Robertson. He is the vice president of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. Scott, are you there with us?
Yeah, here.
I want to hear about self-advocacy. Why is self-advocacy so important when it comes to autism?
I would say that self-advocacy is not just important for people on the autism spectrum, but people with disabilities overall and people in general in society, because I think a vital important part of life is being able to have a degree of direction over things that you want to choose in life. Mm-hmm. And being able to express your needs and wants. And I think that's really important while we're discussing augmented communication technologies today. It's because it's an important part of self-advocacy for many people, especially people on the spectrum who may not be able to express their needs and wants without the technology.
You were on the autism spectrum. Is it fair to say you were an Asperger syndrome person?
Yeah, I'm Asperger's diagnosed on the autism spectrum. I didn't know if it was something we were going to be discussing in the program later on, but the definitions may be changing clinically to autism spectrum disorder. So the exact distinction between Asperger's and PDD-NOS and quote-unquote Connor's autism / autistic disorder are probably going to be shifting. But I'm diagnosed as Asperger's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, as an advocate of self-advocacy, that some of the problems we've encountered in understanding autism, treating autism, come from the fact that autistic people have not been included in that definition, arriving to that definition and that understanding of the condition.
Yes, we have not been involved heavily in the conversation often about the autism spectrum, about services for us, about diagnosis, about pretty much everything regarding autism, which kind of conflicts with many other elements of the disability community. And I say disability because I consider autism more of a disability than a disorder or kind of a brokenness in person, if you will. It's more of something that can involve life challenges, but also great gifts and talents that people on the autism spectrum have. And often we've not been a part of that discussion as we should, because we have ownership of the experience of this disability.
Your article in this latest edition of Disability Studies Quarterly is about quality of life issues. What needs to happen in this area for autistic people?
Well, I think one of the things that needs to happen, certainly on the research end and also occurring in practice too, is just to do more research around these. It tends to be the case that often, and you'll see this for anybody who reads my article, that most of the research out there on autism is on physiology, genetics, in some cases diagnosis, which are important, but what's left out often is research around, say, education, educational inclusion, post-secondary life, some of the challenges, for instance, that impact young people on the autism spectrum and adults equally. For instance, bullying, which I'm studying in my dissertation research, actually, cyberbullying and bullying of adolescents on the spectrum. We need more research of this, and we need more funding around that research. Mm-hmm. And then we need co-occurring kind of impact on practice in terms of development of services and support resources for people on the spectrum, because given the right support resources, the right services, and the right attitudes, my view is that people on the spectrum, across the diversity, can really thrive and function really, really well when we're given the right support and the right attitudes for accepting us and our personhood.
So, Scott, before we have to leave you in just a moment, give us your vision of where we could be in 5 or 10 years. How would it be different in our society in living side by side with autistic people?
My vision is that from an optimistic standpoint is that if we can help to educate society about neurological diversity as a viewpoint of neurological disabilities like autism spectrum and help to change the picture for services and advocacy, we could see a better future than we have today. So I'm hopeful that will be the case. My organization, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, I'm vice president, and we are entirely run by people on the autism spectrum with chapters in the United States, Australia, and other, and in some cases some other developing countries, other countries around the world. We are trying to change the message and work with many allies in the cross-disability community about autism and other disabilities and about the need for services and supports. And we're hopeful that we're going to be able to do that over the next 5-10 years and educate the public about a lot of what happens with the experience of autism. Many people do not really know very well. And I think a lot of the process of education will help kind of transform that picture of understanding that people in the public and the clinical world have about the spectrum.
Okay. Thank you very much, Scott Robertson, for joining us. But we're very glad that you could join us.
Thank you very much.
Neurodiversity, our topic today, getting a lot of different views about this alternative view, not a mainstream view of autism, that it's a sign of diversity in the neurological development, a normal human difference. Joining us, Emily Thornton Savarese by phone, Ralph James Savarese, editors of a special issue of Disability Studies Quarterly entitled Autism and the Concept of Neurodiversity. Joining us from Syracuse University, Jamie Burke, who is a student there, labeled severely autistic, and joining us in conversation with the help of his keyboard. And we want to go to some of our callers. Tricia joins us from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Tricia.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a 15-year-old son that was diagnosed when he was 2.5 and I was told he would not speak and he would not, he would not, he would not. He has overcome all those challenges, and he is would be labeled now high-functioning autistic, but I would think it would be terrible to eradicate autism. Some of the gifts and the value of the way he thinks and the things that he hears, it is amazing to me, and I think we would really be missing out on a lot of art and science and new ideas that have really shaped the way we live, and we don't even realize it.
Interesting, Tricia. I'm sure we'll have some reaction from Jamie about that. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Jamie, or Tricia, joining us from Cedar Rapids, and I hear Jamie clicking away on his keyboard there. I wonder if Jamie has a reaction, or you, Ralph, or Emily?
Well, I would agree with the caller, absolutely, and I would say that there are studies coming out, studies in the last 3 years that support what the caller was saying. There was a study 2 years ago that compared neurotypicals and neuroatypicals, autistics, with the Raven's Progressive Matrices Test of Fluid Intelligence, and it found that autistics were 40%, up to 40% faster with the same error rate. And my son, witty guy that he is, quipped, "Dad, who's retarded now?"
Mm.
So that doesn't mean that there aren't serious challenges, but it's a much more complicated, ambiguous proposition. Jamie, do you have something you want to say? I can hear
it. It's true. The basic belief of hope and engaging, thoughtful journeys of discovery.
Absolutely. Thoughtful journeys of discovery. Just the fact that Jamie is speaking is an incredible discovery, and it's really having an impact on the scientific community.
I'd like to play now a moment of and have Jamie listen to this. And Jamie, please react to this. I know you've heard this before. We're going to play the first part of a fundraising video that was put out by Autism Speaks. Now, that's the country's largest autism organization. It was put out this past fall. The man you heard, Scott Robertson, did a lot to make sure this video didn't get widely aired, because autistic people, a number of people, have real problems with the way autism is portrayed in this video. So I want to ask Ralph and Emily and Jamie, after we hear a little bit of this, what is so objectionable about this video? This is part of a video put out by Autism Speaks. It's called I Am Autism.
I am autism. I'm visible in your children, but if I can help it, I am invisible to you until it's too late. I know where you live. And guess what? I live there too. I hover around all of you. I know no color barrier, no religion, no morality, no currency. I speak your language fluently. And with every voice I take away, I acquire yet another language. I work very quickly. I work faster than pediatric AIDS, cancer, and diabetes combined. And if you are happily married, I will make sure that your marriage fails. Your money will fall into my hands, and I will bankrupt you for my own self-gain. I don't sleep, so I make sure you don't either. I will make it virtually impossible for your family to easily attend a temple, a birthday party, a public park, without a struggle, without embarrassment, without pain. You have no cure for me.
That's a bit of a fundraising video put out by Autism Speaks just this past fall. I want to go to you, Emily Savarese. What is wrong with portraying autism like that?
Well, I think immediately of one of the self-advocates in the roundtable, Tracy Thresher, an adult who lives in Vermont who types to communicate. And Tracy wrote, quote, that the current wars on autism are deeply misled and a strong voice is needed from people with autism. Without that voice, fear will guide the way autism is treated. Mm-hmm. Likewise, if you listen to some of the other self-advocates talk, one of the things they had to do was actually give themselves the confidence and the sense that they were worthy of advocating for themselves. And that is wrong. People should not have to convince themselves that they are worthy of being advocated for. But when you hear things like that ad, in fact, that is something that they have to overcome.
The people putting it out, I would think, of course, are well-meaning. They want to put autism up there as something that we need to battle and that we're not going to give up in our battle for. So they are feeling this is a well-meaning battle.
Surely there's a way to advance scientific agendas without demeaning people. I mean, the voice on that ad was like Satan, and it was there's the suggestion that the kids with autism and that autism itself is some horrible, invasive demon. There's a way to do science without demeaning people. That demeans people.
Let's see if Jamie Burke from Syracuse University has a response to the video and the conversation we've been having since. Jamie?
The voice does not speak to the people of autism in my life. Fears are not supports, but the destroyer of forward movements.
That's fantastic. Fears are not supports. And that you heard Scott talking about the need for supports. It's a destroyer of forward movement. So I agree with you, Jamie, entirely.
186. Yep. Go ahead, Jamie.
All the people who listen with open minds and knowledge that the world reviews the course of communication methods will certainly create a journey to more complete understanding.
Yeah. Jamie, thank you very much. Let's go to a caller if you have a comment or a question for those of us gathered here on the radio to talk about neurodiversity. 1-866-780-9100. Dave is with us from Des Moines. Hi, Dave.
Hi, everybody. I really applaud you for your work, everybody, to bring dignity to your to autism. And I know it's a rough way to go, and I agree with you that video was kind of harsh. But as a father of a small child, I myself am extremely worried about the reported cases of autism, and I was wondering if your experts could speak to that. I mean, the numbers that I've heard that 10 years ago or 15 years ago is 1 in 10,000. 5 years ago is 1 in 166, and now it's 1 out of 4 children are being diagnosed with this. And, you hear about the vaccination scares. You hear that it's environmental. I don't know, but I'm watching my children, and it's not that I wouldn't want them to have the same that I would categorize autism as a disability, but at the same time, if it's an environmental factor or something in a vaccine or something like that, I just don't understand why the numbers are going up so much. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much, Dave from Des Moines. Just getting at the question of what we understand. Do we have an adequate understanding of autism, especially this severe autism?
No, and just to respond to the caller, it's absolutely clear that vaccines did not cause autism. And in the last year and a half to 2 years, any number of studies have proven that definitively. We can't say whether there are other environmental factors, but here's a very important point. It's not 1 in 4. It's down to a 1 in 100, 1 in 110. Maybe I've seen a number of 1 in 60. But you have to understand that the definition of autism has changed over the last 25 years significantly. And as a result, there's more attention to this spectrum disorder, and there are more incentives to labeling oneself as autistic. And so I think it's a mixture of a cultural issues. There's clearly a genetic component. Maybe there's an environmental component. But I agree. Let's figure that stuff out. But at the same time, let's work with the people with autism who are alive on the planet right now to have fulfilling lives and work with parents so that they can do right by their children.
Is there anything to be said in regards to autism in regards to President Obama's priorities and health care reform?
Em, do you want to start on that?
Can you start and I'll...
Yeah, sure. One of the things that the roundtable in the special issue of DSQ is clear about, these are very politically active autistics, the whole range of the spectrum, and they were very, very impressed by Obama's willingness during the campaign to significantly revise the way he spoke about autism, because early in the campaign, he was pretty much his view was very typical. It was a lot of disparaging, semi-demeaning, pathological language. And then some autistics wrote him and met with him, and he changed that language. And in fact, his nominee for the National Council on Disabilities is Ari Nieman, who is the president of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, the organization for which Scott is the vice president. So I think one of the great things about Obama, at least with respect to disability, is that he's willing to listen and revise what he thinks he knows.
Let's go to Ron in Coralville. Thank you for joining us, Ron, on The Exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I'm calling because I'm a member of GRASP, the Autism Support Group, and we have a branch here in Iowa City. GRASP, not sure if you know, is the Global and Regional Asperger Syndrome Partnership. And we invited Ralph and his family to speak, and unfortunately Ralph wasn't able to attend, but Emily and their son DJ came, and we had a great time. And I wanted to thank them for that. But I also wanted to say I object to this video that was put out by Autism Speaks, because it presumes that the people who do not have autism understand it and understand what's going on inside the person who is experiencing autism. And it's, to me, they just do not – it's not something that can really be explained. It's more something that has to be experienced from the inside.
Ron, I think that is such a good point. And I think a big part of this special edition that we've done is asking neurotypicals to stop and listen. So far, so much of what we think we know about autism and what we should do to help people with autism is based on our observation. And when you have people who have communication issues and movement issues, you can't get good information strictly by observing. And when you have so many capable people now on the spectrum who are young adults, and adults who can speak to what their experiences are about and what their frustrations are and what their needs are, it's time to stop and listen to them.
Ron, thank you very much. Calling from Coralville, and we have just a couple of minutes left. I want to put out a question and have Jamie chime in at the very end of our program if we can. I want to ask Jamie, what would you like to have different in 5 or 10 years? How should our view be changed, in your opinion, of the treatment and inclusion of those with autism? Jamie Burke in Syracuse. And let me put that question to Ralph and Emily before we get to Jamie.
I mean, the first thing I'd say is, I mean, inclusion in life, to use Emily's phrase and a phrase that Jamie and others have used. I mean, let's create opportunities. Let's build self-esteem. Let's respect differences. Folks with autism have challenges and gifts. I marvel at my own son's capacity to remember things and to do chemistry problems. I mean, if you gave me a chemistry problem right now, I would be in grave shape. So I think we can move in that direction and then create employment opportunities, independent living opportunities, better access to health care and support services. Em?
I agree. The self-advocates are asking for to be equal partners on research boards for scientific research, on legislative boards that are deciding what supports are needed, what how to fund things. They want to be heard, and they need to be heard. And I hope that 5 years from now, my son and Jamie and others like them will not seem like the exception, but rather will be the rule.
Okay, let's go to Jamie Burke in Syracuse at Syracuse University for the final word. Jamie, are you there? Go ahead.
I would love to sit in a class and not feel like the ball on a room full of squares.
There's a way. You've got a certain poetry about you, Jamie. We love it. Thank you very much for joining us. We have to go now. Our time is running out. Thank you, Jamie Burke, joining us from Syracuse University. It's been great to have you with us.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Very good. Emily Savarese and Ralph Savarese, it's been a pleasure to have you with us as well. Editors of a special issue of Disability Studies Quarterly entitled Autism and the Concept of Neurodiversity. You can find that online,
yes,
and it's just been made available today. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.